Recently, Barings hosted its annual flagship private markets conference, Barings 360, in Boston, Massachusetts. As part of that event, Barings chairman and CEO, Mike Freno, joined Ted Seides, host of the well-known Capital Allocators podcast, on stage for a fireside chat. In a wide-ranging conversation, Mike and Ted discussed a number of topics and themes, including the benefits that Barings gleans from being owned by a 175-year-old mutual insurance company and the trend of alternative asset manager tie-ups with insurance companies more broadly, Mike's views on Barings' strategic positioning and further opportunities for both organic and inorganic growth, and where Mike and the Barings team are seeing opportunities today, including in areas like real estate debt, portfolio finance, direct lending, and capital solutions. With that, please enjoy the following conversation with Mike Freno and Ted Seides.
And thanks so much for being here with us. I want to jump right in. Mike, having an insurance owner, if you look back at the history of MassMutual, is one of the first ones to take it seriously as an asset manager. And would love to hear your experience of what that's like in the asset management business, having an insurance parent.
We think it's one of the best ownership structures you could have. And we're not just, we're an insurer, but also a unique insurer in the fact that we're a mutual company, which means we're owned by the participating policyholders. It's a whole life participating product, which means they tend to take a long-term horizon on things. And so I think from our perspective, that ownership structure of us being able to invest for the long-term is very, very important. But equally so, I think we as a MassMutual and Barings enterprise recognized long ago, and the asset manager as a subsidiary of MassMutual was formed back in 2000. So despite a lot of the trends that are happening now with insurance and asset managers and asset managers owning insurers, it was something that we saw a long time ago as a necessary partnership. So we have always viewed the asset side of the balance sheet as very, very important to the ultimate outcome for the policyholders. And so we're almost exclusively a life and annuity business. And so we have a variety of different types of liabilities, some long, some short dated. But I think as the market has evolved and you're seeing more asset managers get into insurance, they're starting with the shorter dated liabilities. And so that's going to be mostly on your annuity side, and think of things that are anywhere, simple liabilities, we'll call them, anywhere from 3 to 5 to 7 years. So that's relatively short dated. There's pension risk transfer, which is going to be a longer dated approach to that. But the need for incremental return on those assets or on those liabilities has become very, very important to become competitive. It's not necessarily just a distribution. It's got to be what type of return am I going to get? In the annuity space in particular, it's incredibly competitive. And so the incremental return that are generated from unique asset origination, from asset alpha or portfolio alpha, whether it's security selection or asset allocation, has become incredibly important. So there is this symbiotic relationship. And moreover, the ability for the asset manager to grow, not only being an asset manager, but also being a principal buyer of those assets, is incredibly powerful. And so when we're having discussions with LPs, and no matter what size or strategy, without exception, MassMutual owns a bit of the risk of everything we buy. And so from that standpoint, there is 100% alignment in what we do. And I think that's a powerful message to send. So if you look at the long-term nature of how we approach things, we take things on a multi-year basis in terms, we don't have public earnings calls. We're not worried about quarterly earnings from that perspective. We're able to invest in the business, not only from an organic standpoint, but an inorganic standpoint for the long-term benefit of our policyholders. And interestingly, our oldest policyholder is over 100 years old, and she's had a policy for 80 years. So in her mind, she's thinking really long term. And so in many cases, you know, we've got folks who got an insurance policy when they were one year old. And our job is to provide returns to those policyholders over time and be there to meet those, unfortunately, when they pass, to provide for their heirs. So I think there's the alignment of the long-term nature of things, the mutual structure, the ability to represent ourselves as not only an asset manager, but also a buyer of these assets, has become incredibly powerful for us as an institution. And we're slightly different from some of our competitors in the fact that we're owned by the insurance company rather than the asset manager owning the insurance company. But it's clearly who our constituents and stakeholders are, is the ultimate policyholders.
What are some of the subtle differences in being owned by the insurance company as opposed to what we're seeing more recently, the other way around, an asset manager buying an insurance company?
Yeah, I think the structure, again, it's who are your ultimate owners? Who actually owns and what is their long-term goal? Most of the asset managers who own insurance companies are public. And so that's probably the biggest distinction between our business and some of theirs. Some have more integrated asset management capabilities and liability capabilities. Some are separate, some are distinct. But I think from our perspective is the long-term nature of our policyholders and the outlook of that and being privately owned effectively is a real difference between those. And when we started some of these businesses, we've been incubating businesses for 5-10 years before we bring them out and take them to show to third-party clients. We've been doing that on the balance sheet of MassMutual. And again, that's typically not something you'd see if you're needing to justify a 25 times multiple for your stock price. So I think there's pluses and minuses to both, but from our perspective, the way we manage money, the way we want to manage the business is really definitely in alignment.
When you take that aligned model and bring it down to the asset management level on a day-to-day basis of the portfolio managers managing the products, how does that duration impact the decisions that get made that translate into investment results?
Yeah, hopefully they make better decisions because of that, because we're not forced to be worried about short-term gains. Now we're stewards of the business and we're fiduciaries of what we have in terms of managing the business, but also our clients' money. But I think not having the pressure of turning a profit, if you will, day to day, one of our most successful businesses that's been around for over a decade, not turn a profit for 5 years. And that's okay. That's rare that you can structure something like that. That's not a venture type approach. But I also think it bleeds itself into our culture in terms of how we manage money. I mean, we are predominantly investing on the debt side of things. That's largely what our business is. We have some growth strategies in real estate and private equity as well. But when you're debt investors, the reality is mostly the best you can do is you collect a coupon, maybe buy it at a little discount and then hope to get repaid. And so our view is, you know, we look at things in the lens at which Mass would look at things is loss adjusted yield. You know, how much are you actually yielding when you factor in the loss of things? And that permeates to how we underwrite credit. I mean, we'll take advantage of things when they get choppy. And I think that's the time you show and demonstrate that you're more aggressive is when there's volatility in the world. Doesn't often pay to be very aggressive when spreads are tight, structures are weak, and things of that nature. And so again, having the ability to say we don't have to deploy the capital, we don't have to grow at a certain rate, just gives you a lot of comfort to say, let's do what's in the best interest of the business in the long term, not in the near term. And we can, hopefully that's the way we operate with our clients too, is we make, these are relationships that will be built over decades by doing the right thing in the short term. Maybe it's some financial pain is ultimately going to be the best thing for us in the long term.
As you've grown out, there have been a couple acquisitions along the way. How have you thought about the strategic positioning of Barings in an increasingly competitive environment for everything that you do?
Yeah, so we are the, for those that don't know, but we are the combination of four businesses. Back in 2016, we created what is now Barings under the brand of Barings, but it was four subsidiaries that were owned by MassMutual. Babson Capital, which was largely the fixed income business, which many of us were a part of, Barings, which is our namesake, Cornerstone, the real estate business, and then Wood Creek, which is something on the real asset side of things. Mass also owned, for those that don't know, an Oppenheimer funds at that same time. There was a discussion to combine all of those together. Culturally, we felt like the four that were combined to become Barings were a better fit, slightly different from the Oppenheimer brand. We kept that separate. Subsequently, that was sold to Invesco. So we've got the combination of all these, and I bore you with the details on history to say that when you combine those things, you often have businesses or capabilities that maybe you don't want to grow or you don't think can grow. And so we had to take a real internal look and an assessment of things to say, what do we have that are maybe hobbies that aren't really businesses, and make the painful discussion of shutting some of those down, getting out of those, because folks will say, well, they don't take many resources, but they actually do. They take up a lot of infrastructure time. They take up a lot of management time. And so pruning those capabilities back to build a portfolio of what we wanted to start with back in 2019 and 2020, and then start to move and say, how do we now complete this portfolio of capabilities? And our philosophy has always really been, we want to do everything we do, we want to offer it in a global format. So we want to have boots on the ground from an investment standpoint in all regions of the world to be able to do that. We had many of the capabilities, certainly in North America and in EMEA. But as we moved to Asia, we had some gaps, and that's where a number of the most recent acquisitions have been. We've made an acquisition on the real estate side. We've done one on the securitization side, really trying to build out those overall capabilities and be able to offer a full suite of geographic options to our clients. Some want global, some want specific geographies, but hopefully we're there to offer all of those. So when I look how we are positioned today, I'm very comfortable with where the portfolio of capabilities sits. There's not a lot of things that I would say we are just have a big gap in certain things. There are adjacencies that I'll say or tangential capabilities, whether they be in expanding out our asset based lending, which is just vast in terms of all of its different silos, to further geographic expansion and things where we don't have 100% coverage. That's really where we'll be looking to invest in the business and be doing it. Again, we'll balance the growth organically with some inorganic stuff. But I think we are incredibly well positioned where the for the Northeastern folks, the puck is going. And so we certainly will change. And if we have to pivot a little bit, we will. But when folks say, well, every year someone asks me if the strategy has changed. And if your strategy is changing every year, it's probably a pretty weak strategy. I mean, strategy should endure. And we often call it the North Star. That's the direction of travel that we're going. We have to pivot tactically from time to time, depending on what's going on in the markets. But right now, we're really comfortable executing on the strategy with the capabilities we have in the growth in our business will be around just really augmenting some of those.
How do you think about the integration of different businesses as you're bringing them on the platform?
Yeah, there's people involved in integration. So those are always challenging. And so we went through a lot of that. I think, with bringing four companies together from all across the world, we are in more than 20 countries. And so, when folks talk about culture and things, there's different cultures in different parts of the world. And what we often say is we have a consistent philosophy, consistent values of things that we expect from our teammates globally. But what works in Charlotte, North Carolina, isn't always the same in other parts of the world. And I think there was a little bit of just acknowledgement from us to say that we've got to be respectful of different regions when we move into this and assume that the way that's done at our corporate headquarters isn't the only way to do it. So in 2016, when we brought the companies together, from the front office side, if you will, sales and distribution and investment teams, it was like, well, we're done with this in 6 months. Everyone felt like we're going, we're off, we're running. All the support was still operating on different operating systems, was still operating all sorts of different things. And so we've just completed about 3 months ago, kind of the overall transformation. We called it Project Domino, where we ripped out over 30 systems and now we're running on 6. And so that was the final piece, I would say, of integration. And that was a little bit easier because it was one of the things where everyone's going to be disrupted by this. It's not we're taking this legacy system or this legacy system. It's everyone. And we've communicated to everyone that everyone's going to get 100% of what they need, but you'll get probably 75 to 80% of what you want, which means you'll all be equally pissed off, which will be an easier solution because misery loves company. So, I think that is the integrating the four businesses. And then as we look to buy and bring in new teammates and different capabilities, that's a different one too. We do have a philosophy that we're big on a full integration. And so we're not always the best buyer of a principally owned business. Because sometimes the response from the owners is, yeah, we're all for integration, 51% ownership, support us with distribution, give us balance sheet and seed investment from MassMutual, and that sounds like integration. We go further than that. I mean, we take our time in doing it, but we really do want to bring people into the fold. So it does get back to making sure there is a relationship with the partners that you're going to be moving in the real estate business that we bought in Australia. We dated for 2 years. Before we decided to get engaged and ultimately married. And so making sure that everyone is on the same page of that is pretty important because it's clunky. I mean, people have been doing things one way and oftentimes the new teammates bring in good ideas as well. And we've got to be open-minded to say, if there's a better way to do this, perhaps we should pivot to that. But when you bring in, all of us with our own ideas, our own bias, our own egos, it can get messy.
What's an example of one of those messes Let's just talk about the geographic differences where you say, hey, how you do it in Charlotte might not be the best way to do it somewhere else.
Well, I wish there was a mess, Ted. We've executed perfectly. let me think here on what was one. You know, I think it's as simple things as and again, the cultural ones probably don't have any because we learn quickly, at least I learned really quickly on that imposing certain things that are done in our region was not going to work elsewhere. But one of the things I think we did wisely, and this was a good example of upsetting everyone, was when we brought the four companies together, we had three London offices, all pretty dispersed. And originally the first plan was, well, we're going to go move it to Babson because that was largely where the management team was. And it occurred to us really quickly that probably wasn't the best way to do it. And the approach was, okay, we're going to go find a neutral site. And we'll make everyone's commute, train ride, bus, whatever it is, inconvenient for everyone. And we'll all have to sort through that. But I do think those pop up from time to time. And the team is now ready to do that. We've got a system, an instance with our securitization business, an asset-based lending business that we bought down in Australia. It's a relatively small business, but has an incredible system. They built software themselves. It's very much fit for purpose. It would be incredible to expand across the globe. Now, you can't just flip a switch and put millions of lines of data into something, but I think the acknowledgement of everyone saying, okay, this is coming from a much, much smaller business. It's $10 billion of AUM versus a $430 billion manager, but being open to say, look, let's take best practices and spread them throughout the globe. But look, not everyone makes the journey. I mean, there's instances where we had PMs when we combined businesses and there was overlap. The process was going to be a team-based approach. It was an investment committee approach. And certain PMs from some of the legacy businesses said, that's not what I signed up for and I'm not going to make the journey. And I think that's good. I'd rather have that conversation up front and honestly with people rather than having someone be unhappy and linger around. So we've learned throughout time. We've had some learning moments even in recent past of things. And I think we're not perfect by any means, but we're getting better at it.
So I'd love to turn to some views of yours on markets and some of the strategies you're pursuing and maybe just open it up on the macro environment. How are you viewing, we've just had the election, going forward, how any of that impacts how you're thinking about the business?
So from an election standpoint, we've operated as a business through Republican administrations, Democratic administrations. MassMutual has been around for 175 years. They've operated through world wars. I think we have an enduring business that will work through and hopefully prosper in all environments. So that's not really changing, I'd say, at the strategic level by any means. It certainly appears, and we'll see, that there could be some regulatory changes, may make things a little bit easier to do certain things, which I hope will ultimately manifest themselves in a more productive and efficient system. It remains to be seen. So we're keeping our eye on that, but I don't think we're looking to change that. I think one of the trends that won't stop in the macro is we talked about, there's a lot of combinations going on. There's insurance, there's asset managers, then there's also banks and asset managers. There's asset managers on the alternative side going to asset managers from a traditional standpoint, each one looking to fill gaps that they have that they don't want to necessarily build. It's clear what's going on with that. Alternative asset managers and insurance companies. The alternative managers want balance sheet. The insurance companies need more yield, more spread in their portfolio from originated assets. That's a clear one. But more and more, the partnership between alts and traditional managers is for distribution and packaging. I think Brian Moynihan was up here earlier talking about the packaging component of things, and it's something we talk about a lot. As an institutional manager, we're used to institutional onboarding. We give people 40-page documents to sign on. They come with K-1s. Retail space is a 1 to 2 page document and a 1099, much simpler. And so I think getting some of that packaging and capabilities, you're seeing that. And then the banks. The banks are becoming a player in this. There's disintermediation between the banks because of regulatory changes that doesn't allow for them to use as much of the balance sheet or in the way that they would maybe want to. I think I do agree with Brian, what he said earlier, that I think dispersing the risk amongst the economy and globally is better than having it all concentrated with money center banks. So that's good. But where banks will fit in is they are a very, very unique and powerful origination engine. And while we create origination capabilities, we largely go to sponsors. And that's how asset managers traditionally do it. They go through sponsors, whether it's on the real estate side, whether it's on the corporate side. To touch all the possible avenues, you really need a massive origination force. And that's what banks bring to the table. So I think you're seeing more and more of those partnerships coming together there. And everyone, we use the phrase coopetition, will only continue to increase. We'll partner here, we'll compete here, but everyone's trying to fill in those gaps rather than building everything out themselves, because you're just going to get a lot more operating leverage and efficiencies out of your business if you potentially rent some things as opposed to buy or build those.
How do changes in rates, whether they're going to go up or down from here, impact how you're thinking about the business?
Yeah, so, you know, as I think fixed income benefits from a higher rate environment. Certainly things on the high grade side change the trajectory of things a lot more. I mean, when rates are at zero and you're earning 1.5 to 2% for high grade, it's not really that interesting for people. And it's a tax on savers effectively, which forces them into more risk assets. As we've seen rates move up, I definitely think that there is a debate going on between the relative value between equity and credit, equity and debt. And I think depending on your long-term outlook for equity returns in the public equity markets is probably somewhere between 8 and 10% over the long term. We've seen bigger runs than that now. You're getting those opportunities in credit on an unlevered basis. And so I do think that credit, debt, certainly on the real estate side, there's probably, you know, as much value today, and it'll change. I think there's some green shoots coming on the real estate equity side, but real estate debt is incredibly attractive. Our job is to be positioned to capture all environments. And because it's gonna ebb and flow. Regions are gonna have particular appetites for things. Clients are gonna have particular appetites for things. And we don't wanna be just pigeonholed into say, well, we're very good in this particular economic environment. And then we lose our partnerships in the next. So trying to build out a capability set that can serve the needs of clients through multiple cycles is really what we're aiming for.
I'd love to walk through each of your kind of high level product categories and just get your views on what opportunities you're excited about. Yep. You started talking about credit and fixed income. Maybe just jump in right there on the corporate side.
Yep.
What are you seeing?
So we've tried to position our business for simplicity, really, so we can communicate and give the elevator speech to people when they join us and as well to clients. What do? And so we're really alpha generators through two things, through active management and through origination in three broad asset classes. And admittedly, these are broad, but they're narrower than they were when we started this. It's fixed income, both on the public and private side. It's real assets, which would include our real estate and infrastructure business, and then capital solutions, which would include our alternative equity and capital solutions. And some of those overlap. There's concentric circles and all of those things. But that's how we've tried to do it in a very simple way to be able to communicate to people what we do. I want all of them to grow. And I tell folks all the time, and, you know, if a business isn't doing well, what is this something we're going to exit it? If we have a business, we think we have a right to compete. We think we have a right to grow it. And that's where our focus has been. So, you know, for this year, I do continue to see that private credit will be an area of interest. And I'd say credit last year was pretty powerful for us. We're close on the liquid, if you want to call it liquid. It's debatable how liquid some things are in leveraged loans, high yield, structured credit, things of that nature. But that was about half of our gross flows was in more liquid things. I think at the beginning of the year, we would have never projected that to be the case. So we've got some new capabilities that have come on board. I think the high grade side of private debt, if you will, is going to be an area of large growth. It's traditionally been an area that's been purchased by insurance companies. But I think as we think about it, and we've often thought this way, if MassMutual sees an interest in an asset class, it's likely that others will as well. And they may have different liability structures. But if you can get paid more premium for taking no additional credit risk, but maybe taking some complexity or illiquidity risk, and you can do that, by all means, everyone should do that. And I think every portfolio, whether it's an individual, a pension, certainly insurance company, sovereign wealth fund, all has capacity for illiquid assets. And I think that's what, but I do think folks have always been thinking of it on the high grade or high yield side, where am I picking up the most returns? But I think that's going to start, and the conversations will be more and more fruitful on the high grade side. So we've got a lot of optimism on a number of those businesses there. And we've got a new business that just came over to us from MassMutual that was kind of incubated in the past. So we're excited about where that growth is. We started the year with $380 billion of AUM. We're sitting now at about $430 billion. So it's been a pretty good year for growth for us. And the goal is to continue that trajectory of growth in the right way.
As you get those flows into the liquid side, I'm curious, how do the liquid market investing activities influence what you're doing on the private side?
Well, it gives us an insight to I think risk relative value, if you will. I mean, it gives us a much better, because these markets should be somewhat correlated. The private market reacts slower and is probably slower to reprice than what goes on in the public market. In addition, the public market often has head fakes. It has brief periods of volatility where spreads widen, and that's not a real indicator of where spreads are. But I think you should be, again, I mentioned, if you can pick up premium returns by going into either complex things that you can understand or illiquid things, you should be getting that premium. And if you find yourself investing in private asset classes at the same or slightly lower yields, you better have a good reason for why you're doing it, not just doing it for the sake of that. So I think having the capabilities across both sides of things is very important to see. In addition, these markets evolve over time. And what was once private, for those who are can date themselves far enough back, the leveraged loan market was originally called the bank loan market. And it was done because banks traditionally did it. There was no syndicated market. There was no trading. There was no pricing for it. It started off that way as banks were doing it. Then they started forming club deals with a few people, probably insurance companies that wanted to buy floating rate assets that could hedge out the duration side of things. And then it moved into CLOs. Then it moved into prime rate funds. And then we had what became the broadly syndicated and leveraged loan market. So these things evolve over time. And certainly the private credit space is seeing some of that now. There is a middle part of the world today that looks, from a size and perhaps a structure standpoint, that looks more like a liquid loan market, but it's done in a club format. It's not an area that we're in right now, for the most part. We haven't really picked our strategy to go in this. We do things on the syndicated side and then on the middle market side. You've heard from us, hopefully, that we've stuck to our knittings and we're still on that core middle market, but it's evolving. And I think having those capabilities is there. And certainly we've heard also the ability to ramp in the private markets from times becomes challenged as a result of just lack of deal flow. If you don't have a warehouse, it's hard to get portfolios moving. And so having the liquid side of things that are comparable risk as an avenue to help do that is definitely a benefit. And that's not just, I use the example of high yield, but I think that stems also to high grade.
So we've seen these significant flows into private credit, maybe it's from banks, that activity over the last couple of years, we haven't yet seen a cycle. And I'd love to hear your views on what might happen in this world should we run into tougher economic times.
Well, yeah, we haven't had the default cycle since really 08, 09. And so anyone who's fortunate enough to be under the age of 35 hasn't gone through a cycle yet. And so, you know, I think understanding how you'll react to that, the capabilities that have been built around that. What is the process for that? How do you hold on to things? Are you seller? Do you have the capacity to work through those? But we'll go through a cycle. But on in general, I think the industry does a good job of underwriting credit. I think when we look around and see risks to the system, it's not the big, even if it's in the competitors on the insurance space, it's not the big brand names that most people are doing business with here. You know, they're very good. They're very talented. They're very disciplined. It's some of the other ones that come in that are maybe doing things that aren't, because you've got to deploy capital, because you've got to go do things that you look back and say, that feels frothy. Good economics will allow things to make everyone look smart for a long period of time. But we have, as a group, have been through cycles before. We view it as much an opportunity, and hopefully what we can continue to do is what we've done well throughout in all of our strategies is outperform on the downside and then use that opportunity to be very aggressive to outperform when we come back out of it. It keeps getting pushed off. We will have a cycle at some point. It has to happen. I know everyone keeps saying that, and it's been a long time. But at some point, we'll run through a credit cycle and we'll have to work through some defaults. And some of them will be painful and some of them will be ugly. No matter how good of a credit underwriter you are, you're inevitably going to have some of those. I think, again, is how we've tried to build the business with teams of over 100 looking at credit on the high yield side where most of this will happen, is we're going to be prepared to roll up our sleeves and work it out. And that's different from how banks have traditionally done it, which is sell it, move on, I don't want to talk about it anymore, and I'll go on to do the next thing. Sometimes that's appropriate, but other times there's a lot of distress managers that have made a lot of money by people selling at the wrong time because they just couldn't stomach what that process looks like.
If we turn over to real assets, you did mention the attractive opportunity in real estate debt. Mm-hmm. Would love to hear more about post-COVID commercial real estate, yeah. What's happening in that market?
Well, it's still evolving, right? I think there was probably a case 2 years ago in the height of COVID that it was going to be a disaster scenario, and it hasn't yet played out, and it may still be. I think for A properties, B properties, there's a demand. You know, we've sublet. We are a large owner of commercial offices, and our new buildings are incredibly in incredible demand. We're able to sublet things at higher prices than we had leased them ourselves. So, I think that's definitely real estate is local, and real estate is going to be business specific. There's properties that I've looked at in the Charlotte area that are office buildings that probably have negative value because so much is going to have to be invested into them. There's no amount anyone's going to pay because they're going to have to invest so much money to make it more user friendly. But that's still playing itself out. I think everyone is finding where the right balance of attendance in the office is. How much space do we need? What do we want it to look like? I mean, we went from everyone wanted offices to everyone wants a trading floor. I'm sure at some point in the future, I may be out of the business, but people want offices again. You know, you put in amenities into office space. Those probably don't go away. So those are all things that are changing. And then what is the appetite for corporates and employers to force people back into the office? I think right now everyone's working through, we want to entice you to come back to the office. Here's the benefits for it. But even at our parent company, this is not the case for us. They've got over 40% of their team is remote. And that's, when I mean remote, it's not just kind of an hour outside. They're scattered throughout. And how much do you want to bring people back at that point? So that will dictate a lot of what the commercial market looks like. They will work themselves through. The big question remains is how much of that exposure and how punitive will it be on the bank's balance sheets? We heard Brian Moynihan say that from their perspective, and maybe for all the large money center banks, they feel okay with their exposure. You can hear that maybe the regional banks are too. I'm probably less convinced that the regional banks don't have more exposure to go, and then when losses really start to take place, because you can only kick the can down the road for so long, but it will create opportunity. And I would say that we're probably never going to time the bottom perfectly on this, but I would say our team is definitely now actively looking at someone. Just said we were looking at an office property in San Francisco. 2.5 years ago, probably would have never even been a discussion. But I think now you're starting to see things. We're looking at some office in Australia as well for things. So I think it's starting to thaw a little bit. But the main question to me remains the bank's balance sheet on the lending side, which right now they seem to be not as aggressive on that side, which is great, which allows us to be that provider of capital.
So you've had this long history of kind of creating, as you mentioned, products, innovative products that took some time to come to fruition. And I'm curious to ask you about that. And you may have tipped it off by saying there's this mass mutual business that you're bringing under the tent. So I'd love to hear anything new on the horizon.
Yeah. So most of these asset classes, and we go back and we'll tie it into the kind of our heritage in DNA first. I mean, 175 years ago, there wasn't really any public markets. There was government markets to some extent, but every investment you made was going to be done on the private side. It just had to be done that way. And we've shared internally, we were one of the first lenders to Walmart with a preferred. So this would keep Capital Solutions. Okay, here you go. We're going to lend to a small retailer in Arkansas that's a family-owned business that does about $1 million of net income at the time, happens to be named Walmart. We'll offer them a preferred investment, and some of my colleagues from MassMutual here can correct me afterwards, with an equity component to it, with warrants to buy into the company as it grows.
Had you held it?
Long-term Capital Solutions business, long time ago.
Had you held it?
We don't still own it. Then we do the math occasionally on what it would be worth, and it's just painful. But if you held on to anything from back then, it would probably be look good. So there's always been that. I mean, we were one of the first to finance one of the Henry Kravitz deals when he was at Bear Stearns. So we've always kind of been in this. We were in mezzanine lending in the 80s and 90s, 70s, 80s and 90s, early on before that was come. But fast forward to where we are now, more recently, early investors in CLOs and structured credit, CBOs when they first came out. But to where we are today is a business called, we call it Portfolio Finance. It's really a portfolio finance business that was incubated and started at MassMutual in 2017 and just moved to Barings now in beginning of 2024. So it's been incubating for a while. It's a very attractive business. Again, one that is highly structured, one that's very labor intensive. But from our perspective, is a huge pickup in yield above what you would get from a comparative corporate. So think of it as a single A rated pricing anywhere from 250 to 350 over, which if you compare that to corporate is incredibly attractive. And so that business was being incubated, if you will, a large part for MassMutual's balance sheet. It got to the point where it was established. We wanted to bring in partners to do that and then hence move the business to Barings. And now that's what our portfolio finance business is now. So we've got a history of doing these things in partnership with Mass. Having the balance sheet allows us to build track records, to build warehouses, to do things that we think we're uniquely positioned to do compared to some others that don't really have that balance sheet.
You talk a lot about the phrase, the right to win in the businesses you're in. I'm really curious to understand what that means to you.
So we recognize, and I think one of the core values and care, if I can call it characteristics of at Barings, and we use the phrase confident humility, which means you've got some degree of self-awareness that you're not going to be great at everything, right? And if you're fortunate enough to be great at a good many things, focus on those. And so when I say the right to win, there are things that we just don't have or we're not set up to do. It doesn't mean we couldn't make investments over the long term or buy things to do that. But we don't necessarily have the capability. We had a domestic equity business in the US when we combined all the companies together in 2016. And we weren't competitive at it. And it's a tough market to begin with. And the question was, do we really have a right to compete against others who are doing this? Or should we shift those resources elsewhere? And so at times you've got to say, maybe this isn't for us. Somebody else can do it better and let them do that because we do enough things really, really well that we can capitalize on those. And hopefully that's what we've done. When I look across our capabilities, I don't see anything where I'm not very comfortable sitting in front of any of our investors and saying, we are good at this. We are great at this. And if I have a hard time saying that, then we should probably be out of the business. And so, you know, top quartile, top decile performance is what we're always striving for. You'll have some bumps along the way, but I think if we do that, others will respect us as well, that we're not coming in and saying, yeah, we can do all of it. And it goes back to having this level of self-awareness. So we manage just about 95% of the assets for MassMutual. So the general account, we manage the overwhelming majority of those. But there are some things and asset classes that they want that we don't do or we don't think we would necessarily need to build out. And acknowledging that what's better for the overall enterprise is to maybe go use another manager who's a competitor who does that, that's fine. Again, I think that's a level of humility and self-awareness to say, somebody can do that really, really well. It'll benefit the overall family. We're gonna focus on where we can be great and where we think we can win.
All right, Mike, one last question for you before we open it up. You have in your seat the ability to take a step back and look out 5 years to try to figure out where this business might go, to see around corners that the people on the line day to day may not. What are you thinking about for the next 5 years?
Yeah, I think so. We've got some things we're looking at and how we continue to build out. I think our distribution channels are one that we have the manufacturing across the board. I think I look across where we have. We do, as I mentioned before, we want to augment, enhance, and complement the capabilities we have through adjacencies, but you shouldn't expect to see us move into something that has no correlation to kind of the skills that we currently do. So from a manufacturing standpoint, we're in a great spot. The question becomes in the future, are those things going to be in vogue in 5 years from now? And I think today where we are, yes. When we started our private credit business again back in 2012, when Eric joined us and we combined our mezzanine and direct lending businesses together, it was well early in the phase of middle market direct lending, and it did not really start to bear fruit for years. And so you've got to be willing to say, what's the next thing around the corner? I think portfolio finance is another good example of that. This is a business that was done in 2017 and is now being brought on the road for prime time. So we think we're building out those capabilities. There's more and more talk about these type of things and asset-based lending and all of that, but very few have the breadth and depth of capabilities that we do across these. And so that will buy us a little bit of time. The question becomes in 2 to 3 years, what's the next thing we need to make an investment in to further that? Now, I think where the business is evolving is really on distribution, is what channels are going to be the mode for distribution. We do exceptionally well in insurance. We do exceptionally well with our institutional clients. You know, the retail space is growing. We've got to make a decision of how we're going to tackle that market? Do we partner with folks? We've a couple great partnerships, but we'll continue to evolve on that. But right now, I feel like our portfolio is set up at least for the next several years to perform well, and we'll keep investing and innovating to make sure we stay ahead of the curve.
Okay. All right, Mike, I'm going to turn to or two questions. Let's see. What investment are you already in that you think has the most positive momentum?
Well, all of ours have had a pretty good positive momentum. I think that the biz, from a positive momentum, is definitely going to be our portfolio finance business. It's starting from really no real third-party business, and it's going to start to grow. But that is getting a lot of interest from all sorts of things. We thought it would mostly be skewed towards insurance, but it's definitely pivoting towards pensions, et cetera. But I badge that all together within the private credit universe of things. And so I expect all of ours, from middle market lending to the asset-based lending to portfolio lending to real estate lending to infrastructure, to all have exceptional growth in over the next 12 months. I really, when I look at things, I don't see any parts of our business that I expect to shrink. And so we've got momentum in some of those. I'd say our direct lending business went through a lot this year, but has a lot of momentum going into the end of the year, which is very encouraging. I can't say enough things about the team and the partners we have on that going into that. So I think that's going to surprise a lot of people, the success that we're going to have in 25 and 26. But in saying this, graciously and humble as I can, we're set up really, really well. And the hard part for me and the other leaders is it's now up to us to execute. There's not a lot of things that we aren't positioned well to do. It's now up to us to execute, to serve our clients the right way. Eric says this as well. We're in the trust business. We want people to see how we react, how we handle ourselves. But if we can do those things, we're set up very well for I think what the next 3 to 5 years looks like.
Well, I think leaving us with it all on your back to execute is probably a good way to finish.
It's a bad idea.
Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ted. Good to see you. Enjoyed it.
There you have it, my friends, Mike Freno and Ted Seides. Special thanks to Ted for attending the Barings 360 conference this year and for giving us permission to post this episode on our feeds. For more conversations on asset classes ranging from high yield and private credit to real estate debt and equity, please follow Streaming Income on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.